This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this hour, we begin with a really dumb idea. Let's say you have a problem in your home with pests. You've got all kinds of creatures invading your house. In your living room, they run. In the kitchen, it's a party. Bedroom, this is particularly disgusting and aggressive. Garage, a lost cause there, just like in the bathroom. And so, you take action.
Hello, I am Dr. Silo, head of the National Pest Institute, and we have announced a war on pests. We want to say that we have made significant progress in locating and slowing down the advance of kitchen pests. Thank you. And we're trying to unlock the much more difficult problem of living room pests. And we hope someday to be able to announce a treatment for garage and bedroom pests or the particularly terrifying fast-spreading bathroom pests.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yes.
In my house, I notice that I have mice and roaches. I've got them in the kitchen and the living room and roaches in the bathroom and the bedroom. I was wondering if it would be better to get something that goes after mice and something that kills roaches and not think about the room so much.
But you're just going to walk away from the progress we've made in the war on pests to pursue this highly speculative approach?
Well, no. I just think if you have mice, fight mice. If you got roaches, fight them.
And silverfish. I got silverfish. What if I just try something that kills all silverfish wherever they are?
I don't know if it makes sense to turn upside down an approach we've been using for more than a century. Going after individual pests based, what, on their specific genetic makeup? It sounds like something in medicine.
And that's the promise of precision medicine. Delivering the right treatments at the right time, every time, to the right person. And for a small but growing number of patients, that future is already here.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. It's not every day the Commander-in-Chief shows up in your little dream sequence, but he is talking about a very smart idea for the decades-old war on cancer, which has made progress but maybe needs a rethink. That's what precision medicine is all about, and it's very, very different from what President Richard Nixon declared back in December of 1971.
The Congress is totally committed to provide the funds that are necessary, whatever is necessary, for the conquest of cancer.
Conquest of cancer. This week, the National Cancer Institute announced it would begin a new kind of clinical trial that reflects this new precision medicine idea, rather than the older Nixonian D-Day hit the beach war metaphor idea. This trials will group cancer based on genetic mutations, no matter where they live, instead of treating tumors based largely on where they are in the body, lungs, kidneys, liver, sort of as you gather from our little dramatic scene there. Dr. James Dorshow is leading the new study. He's the director of the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis at the National Cancer Institute, and he joins me now from the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome, doctor.
Welcome.
How are we doing in the medical metaphor department there?
I think you're doing quite well.
Would you say that precision medicine is specifically shifting away from location in the body to something much more unique to the specific cells that get involved in cancer?
We're trying to utilize the information about mutations in genes and other molecular abnormalities to specifically direct treatment without regard to where the tumor was initiated.
Is that to say that different kinds of genetic cancer are, in a sense, different organisms in some way?
Well, I would put it this way to give you a specific example. Recent information from a large project called the Cancer Genome Atlas, which has analyzed the molecular makeup and the mutations in many different types of human cancer, demonstrated that a proportion of patients with cancer of the uterus, on molecular analysis, those tumors look much more like cancers of the ovary, and they respond like cancers of the ovary. That wasn't appreciated even 5 years ago.
What do you think accounts for the fact that while there are obviously reasons why lung cancer occurs in the lung based on external factors, perhaps, and that liver cancer occurs in the liver because of the specific physiology of the liver, why would there be this mixing of certain genetic characteristics that could show up anywhere in the body?
Well, let me give you an example, and you used lung, that's a good one. Another good example is melanoma. Both of those tumors, if you look at the degree and range and depth of mutations that you can analyze from large numbers of patients, are at the top of the list. And if you think about it, melanoma, the worst kind of melanoma, is directly related to ultraviolet radiation. The kinds of lung cancer that are most sensitive to targeted therapies against specific mutations are diseases that are related to carcinogens. And so I think that there are different kinds of carcinogens, but across a range of those, we get patterns of significant mutation that really are targets of opportunity for therapeutics.
And let's talk about how challenging this new study is going to be. You're going to group cancers based on genetic identifiers. Do you think there's going to be some sort of cultural resistance in the sense that someone who has lung cancer wants the best possible treatment for lung cancer, and someone who has liver cancer wants the best possible treatment for liver cancer, and might be a little nervous being grouped with someone who has something that up till now has been thought of as fundamentally different?
So you might think that was the case. However, the way this study is organized, we basically recommend that patients get the best appropriate treatment that is known standard of care for their illness at the beginning. The study is organized and will be specifically targeted to patients who do not have further standards of care to be offered. So the patients who will enter the study really have already had what is most appropriate for them.
Can the pharmaceutical industry develop treatments quickly enough to be matched to individual patients? And will there be enormous investments that go into the cure or treatment of a small group of patients with genetic identifiers that then would be useless for a broader population?
Well, actually, this study could not go forward if we had not assembled something that has never been assembled, at least to my knowledge, before, and that is an arsenal of drugs across 20 different companies. 40 different drugs are going to be, at least that's what we've organized so far, but there will be more, because I think the industry has figured out that even these small subsets of patients, and in the future, most diseases will turn out to be not just lung cancer, but one of 20 or 30 different kinds of lung cancer, that this is the way we're going to develop treatments. And so they've been very active in working with us to try to see whether such a study on a national scale could actually be mounted and what the results might be.
Is there resistance in the research community? I mean, the war on cancer and the approach that we've used up until now has certainly had some success. It's reached some plateaus and some dead ends as well. But I'm wondering if the entire grant infrastructure and the way in which we do cancer research is able to turn on a dime here if this proves to be a much more promising approach.
Well, I think that one of the things that I'd like to point out is the genetic information that that comes forward and is produced by the biopsies and the analyses that are done will be made available worldwide. And so that one of the reasons to structure a study like this and one of the reasons for the NIH and the National Cancer Institute to conduct such a study is to try to demonstrate whether or not the risk involved in thinking about changing our paradigm is actually worthwhile, and so that the government should take that risk initially, and if it looks favorable, provide the information that will assist the research community as they move forward to different kinds of approaches.
Now, I know you're a doctor, but we began this segment with a little dream sequence, and I wonder if you could dream with us a little bit and share your sense of the outer vision of this customization approach in medicine beyond even cancer. What do you see happening in, say, the next 50 to 100 years?
Oh, I, Could you give me 5 or 10 years first?
Give me 10. Give me 10.
Okay, give me 10. Give me 10. I think in 10 years, it will be routine that every patient who has surgery for a presumed malignancy and every patient who has a biopsy for a presumed malignancy will have detailed molecular characterization, not only the mutational analyses that we're moving forward with in this trial, but actually even more sophisticated studies of RNA and protein that will help us to a great degree in determining how the treatment should be administered.
And
you know, I probably both of us won't be here in 100 years, but one could speculate that, in fact, we will have blood tests that can detect very early on the possibility that might have there might be malignant cells in some organ that can't be detected yet, and that there will be treatments that will utilize those molecular alterations to eliminate them.
Dr. James Dorshow, it sounds very exciting. He's the director of the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis at the National Cancer Institute. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.